or an anti-Semitic project absolutely false. Of course, there's been, you know, there's an ancient Jewish community in on historic Palestine. This is, you know, not about the identity of those that are massacring us, but it is about the massacre itself. Massacres, genocide, ethnic cleansing, imperialism, these are wrong no matter who is perpetrating them. And we are ready to work, as you mentioned, hand in hand with anyone of any identity who wants to stand in solidarity. So we're grateful for those partners.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Sara Aziza, the Palestinian-American journalist and author. Her new book is just out. It's called The Hollow Half, a memoir of bodies and borders. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for an individual giving manager to support our fundraising team. You can learn more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadouras, and Alkov Temeria, Studio John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Anjali Kamat, Sapkwath Nazal. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Is KBOO Portland.
Camp is in session. Join us at the KBOO station on Friday, May 2nd from 6 to 9 p.m. for KBOO's monthly First Friday pop-up gallery event. Come to Camp KBOO and join us around the mic for an evening of live music, artists, vendors, drinks, food, and more. We can't wait to see you there.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, labor and immigrant rights groups plan to rally on May Day in Salem. U.S. Immigration Enforcement will start surveilling immigrant social media for signs of anti-Semitism. And in international news, Canada's Liberal Party pulls out a win in the national election. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 29, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. Labor and immigrants' rights organizers are calling on Oregonians to support immigrant communities with a rally this May Day, Thursday, in Salem. Data shows immigrants are essential to Oregon's economy, especially in agriculture and manufacturing. KBOO's Lexis Ponce reports.
Labor and immigrants' rights organizers are calling on Oregonians to support immigrant communities with a rally this May Day, Thursday, in Salem. Data shows immigrants are essential to Oregon's economy, especially in agriculture and manufacturing. Comments by Reyna Lopez, Executive Director, PayCoon, Oregon's Farm Worker Union. On Thursday, May 1st, Oregon labor and immigrants' rights organizations are gathering in Salem calling for justice for immigrant workers and an end to mass deportations. Immigrants make up nearly a third of Oregon's agricultural workforce and 20% of manufacturing jobs. Reyna Lopez is the executive director of PayCoon, Oregon's Farm Worker Union. She says the Trump administration's attempts at mass deportations have shaken her community to its core, while inspiring people across the state to act.
Immigrant Oregonians are our neighbors, they're our co-workers, our classmates, our friends, and people who have helped build our state for generations. May Day is about showing that we belong here.
Advocates say supporting immigrants is also important for the state financially. New data shows Oregon's immigrant families contributed nearly $2 billion to Social Security and more than $500 million to Medicare in 2023. Lopez says this May Day in Salem, participants will urge lawmakers to pass legislation that would uplift immigrant families. She highlights the Food for All Oregonians bill, which would extend food benefits to all Oregon children, regardless of their immigration status.
Passing Food for All Oregonians is a part of the Oregon spirit, a part of this value that we stand up for one another and we stand up for what's right.
This is not the first time immigrant communities have been under attack, notes Lopez. She remembers the Show Me Your Papers measures in 2007, a national push to allow local enforcement to request proof of immigration status from anyone. She says those measures led to the largest May Day marches in the history of the immigrant rights movement.
Just remember that the moment that you start feeling like you can't do anything about it, that's when their tactics start to win.
Lopez praises Oregonians for pushing for things like tuition equity for Dreamers and allowing all residents to get driver's license, regardless of immigration status. She says May Day in Salem will see a rally, a march, and many organizations tabling, so it's a perfect place for new people to get involved. For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Lexis Ponce.
In the wake of President Trump's pledge to up military spending to $1 trillion while cutting things like food stamps and education, young people in Washington are making their voices heard. The Youth Activist Leaders Program helps young people learn how to organize their communities to create a more just world. Isabel Charlet has more.
A group of Washington's youth, fresh from a grassroots leadership development program, is speaking up against the Trump administration's plans to cut funding for social programs while investing more in the country's military. The group of young people recently concluded the Young Activist Leaders Program, or YALP, which teaches social justice and community organizing. Nico Jagger is one of the youth leaders of the program. He says in the wake of the Trump administration's pledging $1 trillion to the military, the group decided to wrap up the program's spring session by organizing a rally.
We don't want our money going to war. We'd rather our money go to food stamps, Social Security, healthcare. Those are the things that actually save and improve lives versus war is this machine that just destroys.
The rally featured youth speakers as well as community leaders for fair housing and immigrant rights. YALP is an 8 to 10 week paid internship program run by the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane and will have another session in the fall. Many issues sparked Jagger to get involved in organizing, and he says access to healthcare and insurance for low-income people hits close to home.
I've watched my community, my family be affected by lack of medical care, and it's an awful thing to just have to accept that you can't get help.
Jagger says as a young person, especially below voting age, it can be easy to feel powerless. But he says young people are paying attention and deserve the opportunity to have a say in their own future.
And you can do that through organizing, like our YALP program, or volunteering, or just taking a stance and saying, hey, this isn't right.
Along with helping youth feel empowered, Jagger adds, learning community organizing skills is fun. He says YALP's fall session will be focused on voter engagement. Young people who are interested can visit the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane or PJALS website, pjals.org. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney's Liberal Party wins the country's federal election. This appeared to be a huge turnaround sparked by Donald Trump's annexation threats and recent trade war. Carney's rival, Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre, was voted out of his seat in Parliament. Just months ago, Poilievre appeared to be a shoo-in to become the next Prime Minister. This would have brought the Conservatives back into power for the first time since the 2015 federal election. Recently, Trump launched a trade war with Canada and suggested the country should become the 51st state, outraging Canadian voters. Poilievre, a career politician, campaigned on the adopted slogan, Canada First. But his similarities to Trump may have ultimately cost him and his party the election. The Liberals were projected to win more of Parliament's 343 seats versus the Conservatives. It was not immediately clear if they would win an outright majority, at least 172, or would need to rely on a smaller party to pass legislation and remain in power. Canada said it has decided to pause the counting of special ballots cast by voters who are away from their districts during the election. The Liberals were leading or elected in 168 seats when the counting was paused, four short of a majority. In a victory speech, Carney stressed the importance of unity in the face of Washington's threats. He also said the mutually beneficial system Canada and the U.S. had shared since World War II had ended. Carney said, quote, "We are over the shock of the American betrayal, but we should never forget the lessons, as I've been warning for months. America wants our land, our resources, our water, our country. These are not idle threats. President Trump is trying to break us so America can own us," end quote. Puvalyov apparently hoped to make the election a referendum on former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, whose popularity declined recently as food and housing prices rose. Trump's belligerence has infuriated Canadians, leading many to cancel U.S. vacations, refuse to buy American goods, and possibly even vote early. A record 7.3 million Canadians cast ballots before Election Day. If they don't win a majority in Parliament, the Liberals might need help from one of the smaller parties. Canada is also currently dealing with a cost-of-living crisis, and more than 75% of its exports go to the U.S., so Trump's tariffs, coupled with moving Canada's automobile production south, could severely damage the Canadian economy. While campaigning, Carney vowed that every dollar the government collects from counter-tariffs on U.S. goods will go toward Canadian workers who are adversely affected by the trade war. He also said he plans to keep dental care in place, offer a middle-class tax cut, return immigration to sustainable levels, and increase funding to the Public Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services has started to look into immigrants' social media for anti-Semitism. If they find it, that could be grounds to deny immigration benefits requests. The screening includes people applying for permanent residence and those who are affiliated with colleges and universities. The Department of Homeland Security said it will, quote, "protect the homeland from extremists and terrorist aliens, including those who support anti-Semitic terrorism, violent anti-Semitic ideologies, and anti-Semitic terrorist organizations such as Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, or the Houthis." People applying for immigrant and non-immigrant visas will have to provide their social media handles. Homeland Security will be using AI to comb through thousands of social media accounts to look for anti-Semitism. In recent cases of students who have been detained by ICE, that includes criticism of the Israeli government and their war in Gaza. Rights activists have stated that it is a violation of the First Amendment right to free speech. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Expressions said that the Trump administration was, quote, "formalizing censorship practices." Jeremy Ben-Ami is the president of J Street, a pro-Israel, pro-democracy group. Ben-Ami told NPR, quote, "The fight against anti-Semitism won't be advanced by attacks on 250-year-old cherished American rights like free speech," end quote. Major shifts in environmental protections, immigration enforcement, and civil rights as the Trump administration reshapes government priorities. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Federal law enforcement is trying to send some kind of a message to let state officials know that they will try to aggressively prosecute anyone who can be viewed as interfering in any way with their agenda.
John Gross at the Wisconsin University Law School says federal authorities are threatening state and local officials with the arrest of a Milwaukee judge. Judge Hannah Dugan faces obstruction charges and could spend 6 years in prison after helping an illegal immigrant avoid ICE. Her defenders say there's no basis for the charge since the Mexican man was under no criminal arrest warrant, but was just wanted for a civil procedure. Border Czar Tom Homan says impeding immigration enforcement would be met with prosecution. President Donald Trump is signing several new executive orders. One directs federal and state agencies to publish lists of sanctuary cities that limit cooperation on federal immigration moves. Another reinforces English language requirements for commercial truck drivers, citing safety concerns. A third directs the Justice Department to provide legal resources to police officers facing lawsuits for acts while on duty. The Justice Department's Civil Rights Division is undergoing a major upheaval. Hundreds of attorneys and staff are resigning in protest over the administration's shift away from traditional civil rights enforcement. A new report warns a proposal to privatize the Postal Service could hurt 100 million Americans in small towns and rural areas. Proponents argue corporations would run it more efficiently. Sarah Anderson with the Institute for Policy Studies says their study confirmed that it's not profitable to deliver outside of cities.
without competition from a public service that has a mandate to provide affordable delivery to every address in America, people in these areas in particular might lose their delivery at their homes altogether.
Elise Ketchum with the Arizona Wildlife Federation says a proposed EPA rule could leave Arizona's ephemeral streams, which only flow after rain, vulnerable to pollution.
There's that danger of we've lost federal protections for those types of water streams. In Arizona, now we have no federal, no state protections for ephemeral.
Administrator Lee Zeldin says the changes could ease burdens on farmers and landowners, but experts fear weakening protections will further strain one of the nation's driest states. South Dakota LGBTQ plus advocates are sounding alarms over a proposed federal budget cut that could eliminate specialized crisis support through the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Rachel Poland with Sioux Falls Pride says the hotline has been vital.
Some of these kids don't have any supportive voices in their life. They are exploring an identity that maybe they came out and were rejected by family or friends in their area.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Street Roots Spring Anthology, Volume 2, out tomorrow. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be partially cloudy and reach 65 degrees before dropping to 53 to 44 degrees during the evening. Tomorrow's weather will be a high 70 in the afternoon, then drop to 45 in the evening. Today in history, in 1429, during the Hundred Years' War, 17-year-old Joan of Arc led the French force to take back the city of Orleans. The quote of the day is from French mathematician Henri Poincaré, who said, quote, "It is by logic that we prove, but by intuition that we discover. To know how to criticize is good, to know how to create is better." The Nevada State Senate debates a bill to formally reschedule Indigenous Peoples Day to match up with other celebrations around the country. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. A bill to formally reschedule Indigenous Peoples Day in Nevada has just been heard in the state's Senate Committee on Government Affairs. Assembly Bill 144 would make the second Monday in October an official commemoration of Nevada's Native and Indigenous residents. Currently, it's held on August 9th. Democrat Shay Backus is the bill's sponsor and a self-described urban Indian who is a member of the Cherokee Nation. Speaking to the Senate committee, she reiterated that her bill would not replace the state's observance of Columbus Day on that same date.
AB 144 will align the date to honor the resilience of our ancestors and to uplift the enduring legacies of Indigenous peoples, their voices, their cultures, and their connection to this land.
Backers of the bill included the Native Voters Alliance Nevada and the Sierra Club. Joshua Skaggs, Legislative Affairs Director for the Nevada Republican Party, read President Trump's recent statement in opposition.
You'll be happy to know Christopher is going to make a major comeback. I am hereby reinstating Columbus Day under the same rules, dates, and locations, and it has had for all the many decades before. End quote.
The bill previously passed the Nevada Assembly on a 27-15 vote. More than $2 million in federal funding will go to expand rental assistance for Native American veterans at risk of becoming homeless. As Danielle Kading reports, Housing and Urban Development Secretary Scott Turner announced the money on the Oneida Nation's reservation last week.
The money will be made available through HUD's Tribal Veterans Affairs Supportive Housing, or VASH, program. The Oneida Nation has helped Native American vets under the program for the last decade. The tribe's chairman, DeHasse Hill, says it's helped meet the community's needs for affordable and available housing.
That includes emergency housing, transitional living, and a path to home ownership.
HUD Secretary Scott Turner says more than 500 veterans in 29 tribal communities are currently being housed under the program.
HUD VASH delivers critical rental assistance to Native American veterans and tribal communities all across our great nation, including Oneida.
One Oneida vet says the program helped him and his two sons find housing after he was evicted and ended up living in his car for several weeks. Republican Congressman Tony Weed says he looks forward to working with Secretary Turner to ensure communities like the Oneida Nation have access to housing. More than 1,100 veterans have received help under the federal program. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
All across Indian country, people have been observing Sexual Assault Awareness Month. While April is winding down, people like Desiree Coyote want the message to continue year-round, that the community needs to unite to help prevent sexual violence and form support for survivors and their loved ones. Coyote is the Family Violence Services Program Manager for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation in Oregon. When she talked to National Native News on Monday, she and her community had just finished a sexual assault awareness walk.
About 50 folks join us, Native and non-Native alike.
Coyote says another walk is taking place this Wednesday in Roy Raley Park in Pendleton.
We're braiding ribbons together to honor a variety of issues like sexual assault, domestic violence, missing, murdered, and trafficked. And whatever else the folks want to attach to that.
The FBI says from 2021 to 2023, there were nearly 26,000 reports of violent crime and roughly 8,600 incidents of sexual crimes against victims who were Native American or Alaska Native woman. More events will take place on May 5th, which is the National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. Again, Desiree Coyote.
Families want folks to remember that these are our community members, they're our relations, and that they are not forgotten, that we still hold ceremonies to be able to speak their name so that everybody can remember who our Indigenous missing and murdered are.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull from the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
The Bonneville Power Administration is considering joining an energy market that covers a larger geographic area to make energy delivery more reliable in the face of more extreme climate events. The administration has shown a preference to A-Markets Plus, but advocates for clean energy and salmon are urging it to go with the day-ahead energy market. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
A major player in the Northwest energy landscape is considering changes in the future as extreme climate events make power delivery more unpredictable in Oregon. Like utilities in the region, the Bonneville Power Administration, a nonprofit federal administration, is considering joining a larger energy market to ensure reliable access for customers. BPA is favoring a market known as Markets Plus, which it says will be less expensive in the long run, but could cost between $79 and $129 million more for ratepayers in 2026. However, organizations like Save Our Wild Salmon favor the day-ahead energy market, or EDAM. Tanya Reardon with the organization says BPA needs to consider tribal rights in the region, especially when it comes to salmon.
We can have a more open governance model that gives state officials, consumers, an equal role, which would keep salmon recovery priorities at the forefront, which is what the EDAM market would offer.
Reardon says the transition to a larger energy market would reduce pressure on the federal hydropower system, also reducing pressure on the region's rivers and salmon. A formal document outlining BPA's decision is expected in May. Ben Otto with the Northwest Energy Coalition also favors EDAM. He says the BPA has a unique role in the Northwest with obligations to its customers, but also to the rest of the region by selling hydropower to keep bills low and running a transmission grid in the Northwest.
Also by mitigating the impacts to salmon and wildlife and tribal interests, this is really important. And we really think that those obligations need to play a more significant role in Bonneville's decision. And we look forward to that being reflected in their record.
Otto says EDAM would reduce cost and be just as reliable as Markets Plus, and would make the integration of clean energy easier. He notes that BPA wouldn't fully join the market, regardless of its choice, until 2028, and so he's urging the administration to take its time making a decision.
We believe a market that gives a strong role for public interest and state policy is a better fit for Bonneville's obligations than Markets Plus, which is really more of like a business league and more commercially focused.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A special component of the nation's 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline has served more than 1 million LGBTQ plus youth since 2022. But the Trump administration is reportedly eyeing removing all funding for this arm of the hotline, and advocates say such a move could come at the worst possible time. KABU reporter Kenny B. has more on the story developing in South Dakota.
LGBTQ plus advocates in South Dakota are reeling from passage of another state law they say harms their community. Now there's concern possible federal budget changes could eliminate a tool that serves a sympathetic ear. The Trump administration's emerging federal spending plan includes possible cuts to funds that cover a specialized service under the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. This sub-feature gets routed calls from LGBTQ youth who have expressed suicidal ideation. There are unknowns about what service disruptions would look like, but in a worst-case scenario, Rachel Pullen of Sioux Falls Pride says not having someone on the line who understands them would be a blow. And I quote, "Some of these kids do not have any supportive voices in their life. They are exploring an identity that maybe they came out and were rejected by family or friends in their area." End quote. The Trevor Project says these youth are four times as likely to attempt suicide than their peers. The group is among those reporting White House plans following a leaked memo. The Health and Human Services Agency is undergoing a major reorganization, officials says, aligned with their vision of its new secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. The specialized 988 service has logged more than 1.2 million crisis contacts since its launch. The news comes after South Dakota's governor signed a law banning trans students from using communal facilities that match their gender identity at public schools. The governor said it represents freedom from a woke agenda, but Poland says affected youth might feel more isolated as a result, and potentially losing easier access to a trained voice to hear them out that could make things even worse. And I quote, "Especially in our rural areas in South Dakota, where counseling service might not be acceptable for some of these youth, acceptable or accessible, I could definitely see more tragedies, self-harm, suicidal behaviors, and unfortunately more deaths could occur." Advocates say that's why it's even more important to maintain the crisis service for this population. Congress does have a say in the next budget, and it's unclear how the administration's push for cutting discretionary funds will play out when those talks ramp up towards October 1st deadline. For KABU News and Public News Service, I'm Kenny B.
U.S. nuclear talks are moving forward, but key disputes remain regarding Iran's uranium enrichment levels and U.S. sanctions. Trump claims nobody else can get an agreement, but Obama did in 2015, only to have Trump withdraw from it. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. He says what may complete a deal now is the domestic turmoil in both countries. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. The Trump administration has reportedly decided not to approve an attack on Iran for now. Apparently, those in the administration who are not convinced an attack would eliminate Iran's nuclear program and who worry about a wider war have prevailed over hawks who want the attack to go ahead in conjunction with Israel. Trump has given Iran 2 months to decide whether or not to negotiate a new nuclear deal. Says Trump, quote, "I think that Iran has a chance to have a great country and to live happily without death. That's my first option. If there's a second option, I think it would be very bad for Iran, and I think Iran is wanting to talk," unquote. The war talk is backed by deployment to the Middle East of two aircraft carriers and to the U.S. base at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean of around a half dozen B-2 bombers capable of carrying 30,000-pound bombs meant to destroy Iran's underground nuclear program. The administration's pressure tactics may not work. Some reports say Iran has been assured that the U.S. isn't demanding the complete elimination of Iran's nuclear enrichment program, but other reports point to enrichment as a central issue. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has said that Iran has no need to enrich uranium and should instead import its nuclear fuel. And that's just one point of contention. Consider this. The Omani Foreign Ministry, which is brokering the U.S.-Iran talks, said the goal of the talks was to reach, quote, "a fair, sustainable, and binding agreement to ensure that Iran is completely free of nuclear weapons and sanctions while preserving its right to develop nuclear energy for peaceful purposes." Let's examine the fine print here. Sustainable and binding agreement. As Trump has already shown, an agreement with one U.S. administration isn't binding on another. He simply abandoned the 2015 deal. Then the other point, Iran is completely free of nuclear weapons. Well, how will Iran's nuclear enrichment program be subject to international inspection? Free of sanctions. That would be a major step for this administration to take, considering that it has used sanctions in the past to bring the regime down. The right to develop nuclear energy. Well, the U.S. has granted that right, but it collides with the enrichment issue. In short, the same issues that plagued U.S.-Iran negotiations 10 years ago are back again. But this time, Iran must negotiate with an administration that is under Israeli pressure to go to war if it doesn't get what it wants. The U.S.-Iran talks have now moved to the so-called expert level. That doesn't mean an agreement is within reach. Agreeing to technical talks suggests both sides are expressing pragmatic, realistic objectives for the negotiations and want to explore the details, says one expert who has long studied Iran's nuclear program. The devil is in the details. Sanctions on Iran are probably a key topic at these expert-level talks, as are measures to ensure that Iran's nuclear energy program is separate from any bomb-making facility. Exactly which sanctions on Iran might be removed, and what level of uranium enrichment would be acceptable to both sides, are central questions. In the best of worlds, a U.S.-Iran nuclear deal should stand a good chance of getting done, mainly because both sides have strong incentives based on troubles at home. Iran's economy is in a shambles, and its public is uneasy. Neither Russia nor China is in a position to bail it out. Removal of sanctions would be a major benefit to Iran, especially its oil exports. On the U.S. side, the Trump administration's global tariff hikes, particularly on China, are producing more backlash than a rush to Washington to renegotiate terms of trade. Trump's entire domestic program is in upheaval, and his hope to engineer a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine seems increasingly unfulfillable. And let's recall what Trump said about the nuclear deal President Obama worked out with Iran. He called it one of the most one-sided transactions the U.S. has ever entered into. One approach to a breakthrough agreement is a U.S. easing of sanctions on Iran as Iran produces evidence under international inspection that it has halted uranium enrichment. Elimination of the sanctions would depend on evidence that Iran is moving back to the very low level of enrichment, under 4%, that it agreed to in